There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LeBurge, and this is The Reconnect. We're here to speak the truth on the real issues of the day in real time. So how do we do that? How do we get God back into the conversations of the day? How do we enter into conversations as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ and speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? Today, that means the eclipse. Let's face it, people don't need another piece of our mind or an opinion piece on the eclipse. They need the very piece of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? That's a good question. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. While you're there, you can sign up for our email newsletter. We'll send you out some information and commentary we don't have time to share here on the air during this hour. But you could also like The Reconnect on Facebook and let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LeBurge. All right, friends, the eclipse. The eclipse is the big news of the day. This is the first solar eclipse to cross America in 99 years. And to some people, it's what they are experiencing and describing to others as an act of God. So we have in the Washington Post a reporter who describes it this way. On Monday, August the 21st, in the middle of the day, that would be today, the sky will go dark. The temperature will suddenly get several degrees colder. Birds will stop chirping and retreat into their nests. Tens of millions of people crammed into a 60-mile-wide path that crosses from Oregon to the Carolinas will stand in America looking up at the sky. Now, Just for a moment, consider what you know about the Bible and about what the Bible says everybody is going to be doing simultaneously when Jesus returns. What are we going to be doing? We're going to have our eyes fixed upward, not just for a 60-mile swath across the United States of America, but everybody around the world simultaneously is going to be looking to the heavens because whatever it's going to be, we're all going to experience it, the return of the Son of God, simultaneously in one, it defies description. It's going to be so, it's indescribable. We can't anticipate it. We don't quite know what it's going to be like. But apparently we are all going to have our eyes fixed upon the heavens. It's easy to understand why lots of people view the solar eclipse as an act of God, particularly because of the Bible's conversations about light and dark. And so Julie Zalmer, again, this Washington Post reporter, says this: the total solar eclipse that will cross America, an event that last happened 99 years ago, will be an important moment for scientific observers and a massive nationwide spectator event. But it is also, for many people of faith, evidence of God's majesty, and even to a few, a harbinger of the coming of the end of the world. Now, if you are not a person who is familiar with this kind of prophetic understanding of the second coming of Christ or the end of the world, there are some things that you should be brought up to speed about. So the person with whom this author, this journalist, had a conversation about these things, is a person who clearly understands and believes from the book of Revelation a very, very literal interpretation of some things. And so I'm not here to decry that. I'm here to let you know that that is the interpretation of the individual interviewed here in the Washington Post, who says, the Bible says a number of times there are going to be signs in the heavens before Jesus Christ returns to the earth. We see this as possibly one of those signs. This says Gary Ray, who is the person interviewed here. And it says that he is more interested, actually, in another astronomical event, which is just kind of fun to say, right? This is an astronomical event. Like, it's actually an astronomical event. So not just in like, you know, fun parlance, but it's actually astronomical. Okay, so this astronomical event is going to happen, in this total solar eclipse. But then 33 days later, after the eclipse, on September 23rd, did you know that something else is going to happen in the heavenlies? All right. So the book of Revelation talks about this second thing that is going to happen. And Gary Ray believes that this description in the book of Revelation is descriptive of what's going to happen on September the 23rd. So listen up. Here's what he says. The book of Revelation describes a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She gives birth to a child who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter while she is threatened by a red seven-headed dragon. The woman then grows the wings of an eagle and is swallowed up by the earth. So Ray says, this individual who's interviewed for this article, says that image will be created in the sky on September 23rd. The constellation Virgo, representing the woman, will be clothed in sunlight because of its position relative to the sun, over the moon, under nine stars and three planets, or, as you will note, a total of 12. The planet Jupiter, which will have been seen which will have been inside Virgo, or in her womb, so to speak, by Ray's interpretation, will then move out of Virgo as if Virgo is giving birth. Obviously, astronomers don't see this as something that God is signaling, but Mr. Ray does. And my guess is so do lots of other people, which is why I bring this to your attention. I'm going to read this paragraph to you. Ray thinks the two eclipses, the one today and the one coming 33 days later in September, that these two eclipses, slated to travel across the United States in 2017 and 2024, together marking an X across the nation, could be the starting and ending signs bookmarking a seven-year period of awful tribulations that Revelation says wait in store for non-believers who are left behind all on earth when the rapture occurs. Well, if that's true, then those who anticipated that the rapture is going to happen before the beginning of the seven-year tribulation, if you are hearing this episode of The Reconnect, then we've been left behind. Because you can't have the seven-year period of tribulation between 2017 and 2024 if indeed these were the markers of the beginning and the end of that period of time. He says this, of course, the time frame is speculative, but it makes a lot of sense to me. There's lots of things that point us to that. We have had this conversation before. Anybody who thinks they can read the signs of the times quite that clearly believes they know better than Jesus. When Jesus was asked, okay, precisely when is this going to happen? When are the things that you foretell about the coming judgment and about your own second coming? When is that going to happen? Jesus says, look, it's not for me to know. Certainly not for you to know. God alone knows. And so when God determines that time is full, at what the Bible describes as the fullness of time, Jesus is most certainly going to return in the fullness of his glory, and we will look upon his wonderful face. And the things of this earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. But unless I'm wrong, today's not that day. All right. And so someday is going to be that day. But you and I have no idea when that day is coming. And so we look with hopeful anticipation for the coming of the Lord, for the return of the Lord. And we live our lives as, you know, servants who are prepared and ready to present ourselves worthy with a sacrificial life. Right. That's why we actually live the way we do. We're actually anticipating the return of Christ. And that to him, we're going to have the honor of giving a life that was well lived to his glory and honor and in his name here upon the earth. That's the daily sacrifice that we make in the service of and honor of Christ. All right. So one of my favorite parts of today and this whole eclipse thing has been, that everybody is singing Total Eclipse of the Heart. It's probably a time thing for me, like, right? There's something about that song that takes me back to a certain point of time in life, and they must have been good because it makes me smile to think about it. So some important notes that folks have been lifting up. Obviously, people were not supposed to look directly into the sun just prior to and just following the total eclipse. Why? Well, because it burned your eyes out. OK, now, for those of you who have read the Bible and understand it, that's not actually totally new. Like, there, that should make us, like, think, all right? There are times when God says, hey, you can't look right at me, right? It won't just burn your eyes out. It's just going to, you just, poof, you're just going to smite you dead. That's it. You're just poof. Okay? So I want you to think about Peter, James, and John on the Mountain of Transfiguration. It says Jesus was transfigured before them, and he was so dazzling white, they couldn't look at him. Like, it's just you can't look at him. You cannot look on the glory of the Lord. Remember the prophet who had to be hidden in the cleft of a rock, just so that as the Lord passed by, he would be protected from looking at him. Because if you can't gaze upon the fullness of the glory of the Lord. I was also reminded about God's instruction to Lot. Do you remember what God says to Lot as he's you know, fleeing with his family from what is coming upon the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah? God says, don't look back. Well, Lot's wife did. She looked back. She looked at whatever that blazing wrath poured out upon Sodom and Gomorrah was, whatever that looked like, turned her into a pillar of salt. Conversations about light and dark are important to have. And the Bible is literally filled with language that you can use and you can rely on to have conversations with other people about the power of light and, yes, the power of darkness, the chilling effect that darkness has upon the earth, and in fact, the illuminating effect that the light of Christ has upon each and every one of us. Jesus, in fact, is the light of the world. And Jesus sends us to bear his light and his likeness into the world that he so loves, that other people might come to see. You know, you can't see if it's dark. You can't see if you're blind. But by grace, the light of Christ, by the power of the Holy Spirit, can penetrate the darkest of hearts. So as you're thinking about the eclipse today, I want to leave you with this. Jesus is the sun, S-O-N. A little play on words here. Jesus is the Son on whom you can safely and confidently fix your gaze, fix your eyes, and fully gaze. Maybe a better song for Christians today instead of the total eclipse of the heart. Maybe a better song for Christians today is turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. The things of the earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. All right, friends, let's change gears here. Let's have a conversation about diversity in America and what the diversity of opinions in America and the diversity of understanding in America about one another, what that is driving us to and what it's driving us toward. I have some deep concerns about what we are seeing and experiencing together as neighbors in this nation. And I want to, I think I'll just focus in today on the subject of free speech. Lots of conversation about free speech over the weekend. Lots of ongoing conversation about free speech in the culture at large. So I want to talk about free speech, what it is, and maybe get us thinking a little bit about what it is not. So free speech includes all the kinds of speech you don't like. You just have to know that. Free speech, the guarantee, the constitutional guarantee of the freedom of speech in this country actually guarantees speech that you find offensive. Popular speech doesn't actually need protection, right? We don't need to be protecting people's right to popular speech. Popular speech has the benefit of public support. But recently, there's more and more speech, it seems, that people find offensive. Even the whole concept of microaggressions has emerged as a part of this ongoing conversation. People demanding that their viewpoint not only be heard, but that every opposing viewpoint be silenced. Okay, do you see how that's a problem for free speech and for free speech advocates? And do you also see how if you degrade free speech to something less than free, you degrade the opportunity to proclaim the gospel? Because after all, the gospel is offensive. It is offensive to those who don't believe. We already know that. So is the gospel, is the proclamation of the gospel, is evangelism hate speech? Might it become so? So there is a close connection between the guarantee of the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion and the freedom of assembly and the freedom of the press. These are actually intimately related ideas. which is why they all appear in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States of America. Recently, as more and more speech has become more offensive to more people, the question is actually raised, do we want to extend protection to that speech, whatever that speech is that we happen to find particularly offensive? So it has become fairly commonplace these days to hear about protests and threats keeping, let's say, conservative speakers off of liberal university campuses because of the content of their speech. From Middlebury to Berkeley, liberal schools have been, you know, basically failing the free speech test. So it might not surprise us in the cultural climate of today that that conservatives are finding less and less, sort of opportunity to speak their piece in places where the prevailing opinion is the winds of prevailing opinion are blowing in the other direction. But it might surprise you that Richard Dawkins is now having a hard time finding a platform in our culture. Yes, the atheist evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins. Rejecting speakers like Dawkins is actually something new. So a Berkeley area radio station, KPFA, canceled a scheduled book event with the renowned scientist and author due to, quote, abusive speech. Abusive speech of what kind? Well, specifically against Islam. Dawkins, who views himself as an equal opportunity religion critic, knows exactly what this is about because he's been criticizing Christianity for years. And now he's, you know, equal opportunity. He's also criticizing Islam. It was his comments on Islam that riled people, not for a very long period of time, his criticism of Christianity, which is equally vociferous. So he actually released an open letter in response, pointing out the hypocrisy. He said this: I am known as a frequent critic of Christianity and have never been deplatformed for that. Why do you give Islam a free pass? Why is it fine to criticize Christianity but not Islam? That's an excellent question and an excellent conversation that we need to have here in our culture today. So here's where I think this conversation then needs to go. Undergirding the conversation about speech is a conversation about what is hate, because what people are trying to eliminate is hate speech. So what is hate and who gets to define it? These are actually moral questions and moral categories. So how do we as a society answer moral questions without reference to a moral authority beyond the prevailing public opinion of the majority? Well, that's a question that Ryan Anderson has weighed in on related to the Southern Poverty Law Center and the labeling of several conservative organizations as hate groups. Let's listen to what Ryan Anderson has to say.
We have a problem in the United States with hate. We saw this last week in Charlottesville. Whether it's be racism or anti-Semitism, whether it be the KKK or neo-Nazi, those are hate groups, and they have no place in the United States, and they should be condemned without mincing words, without any equivocation. We see this with the Southern Poverty Law Center. They're labeling good groups that they disagree with as hate groups. So they label the Alliance Defending Freedom, a public interest law firm that just this year won a Supreme Court case 7-2 defending religious liberty. They label that group as a hate group because they disagree. They label the Family Research Council, a think tank here in D.C. that defends marriage and the family, they label that group as a hate group. 5 years ago, a shooter walked into the Family Research Council and started shooting because he found them listed as a hate group on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. CNN itself reported this fact 4 years ago when he was convicted of domestic terrorism for shooting at this think tank. It's irresponsible for CNN today to be simply reprinting SPLC's hate map as if it's fact. It destroys the label of hate, and it trivializes the real evil that is out there. This isn't news. This is simply lefty propaganda.
As Ryan says, we have a problem when organizations label good groups as hate groups. And now we have the problem of defining what is good and what is bad in the culture and whose speech we're going to limit. It's important for us as Christians to engage this question with our feet firmly planted in the never-changing truth. Because while God is light and in him there is no darkness, God also hates that which competes with him for his children's affection. So it's not as if there's no hate speech in the Bible. It's just that the things that God hates are the things that we are also in turn supposed to hate. And it is about God's righteous jealousy for us. God's not jealous of something or someone else. God's jealous for our affection. So God hates evil. Do we? God hates evil so much that he left the glory of heaven to condescend to our mortal reality and deal with evil's power and penalty on our behalf. Are we willing to give up whatever positions of privilege we might have to condescend to the reality of our own culture today, to actually stand in the way of evil's advance in our generation? I think those are some of the questions that Christians are going to have to answer. When it comes to the answer to the question about free speech, what we really have to determine is how we, in a pluralistic society, are going to make room for what I would describe as competing truths. Truths have always been, or at least, you know, everybody's understanding, various understanding of what truth is, have always been competing in what we'll describe as the marketplace of ideas. You can look at Acts chapter 17, where Paul, engages with religious people in the Areopagus in Athens. And you can think to yourself, what would that look like for that kind of free exchange of ideas to happen today in the public square of America? Why is it not happening? As Christians, we're called not just to speak, but to be people who live the truth. Right? We need to enter into the marketplace of ideas, prepared to have conversations with people who are culturally minded. And we need to not be concerned that the quality of our life or our character is going to actually impede their ability to hear what we're saying about the truth of the gospel. So you and I can't be purveyors of the truth unless we're living lives of truth. So that's what I'm going to encourage you to be and to do. Paul could say what he said to the Athenians because Paul was living a transformed life. Paul possessed the mind of Christ and he was possessed of the Spirit of Christ. And he didn't just advance the gospel in words. He was living the gospel, advancing it always and in all ways. That's our challenge and that's our calling in the world today. What would it look like for the world to have no argument against the evidence of our lives? I want you to think about that. What would it look like for the world to find no argument with the excellence and the evidence of our lives? Could they come to know the truth that sets them free, not only by our verbal testimony, not only by what we're saying, but by how we're living and how we're treating others? All right, friends, I think that is indeed the great challenge before us in the culture today. I even think it's a challenge in our own homes, and we're going to have that conversation with Joshua Straub right after the break. This is The Reconnect, and it's a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. We would appreciate it if you took a minute and visited us at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the email. You could pre-order the book. It's entitled Speak the Truth, How to Bring God Back into Every Conversation. You could also share today's podcast with someone else. Like, I think that one of the things that we're going to hope that you're going to do is you are going to become part of the tribe that actually advances this ministry to others. We'd love to send you a resource that we call the Reconnector. If you go to the website and sign up for the email, we'll be sure to get one out there to you. Reconnectors are people who are our ministry partners. They partner with us prayerfully and financially to expand the reach of the ministry to more and more people. And you can find information about becoming a Reconnector at reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, friends, this is The Reconnect. I'll be right back. In the meantime, visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com.
Reconnect One with Carmen LaBurge.
On Monday, August 21st, all of North America will have the chance to witness a lunar eclipse of the sun, where the moon passes between Earth and sun, obscuring its light. Those who live on a path from Oregon to South Carolina will have the rare experience of a total eclipse. If you are on the path of totality, this incredible and rare event will be visible for only a few minutes. And thank goodness, we need the sun. Without the sun, our planet would be uninhabitable. In God's divine providence, the sun makes life possible. That got me thinking. When Jesus, who is the sun, S-O-N, is eclipsed in my life for even a moment, the cold darkness bears in. So if we want to shine the light of Christ to others, we need to guard against anyone or anything that might eclipse Jesus in our lives.
Reconnect today's headlines with God's perspective. Visit reconnectwithcarmen.com. Reconnectwithcarmen.com.
I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about what people are talking about, equipping you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends, while you're at the website, sign up for our email list. We'd love to send some things out to you, complimentary resources to keep you equipped in your efforts to reconnect the eternal with the everyday and bring God back into the conversation in ways that honor Jesus. So again, the website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. All right, friends, I'm excited to have back with me here today on The Reconnect, Joshua Straub. He's a marriage and family strategist for Lifeway Christian Resources. He's a child psychologist. We have talked before about things related to kids and parenting and the need for forgiveness in our households. We've talked about Safe House, which is one of Joshua's books. It is how emotional safety is the key to raising kids who live, love, and lead well. Josh has used his experience and knowledge in the area of trauma trauma to help people around the world. And now he's helping people right here. He's helping us. He and his wife actually have a podcast called In This Together. It's a weekly podcast, and it's a resource that I would certainly commend to you as you are seeking to engage in healthy ways as Christian parents in the culture today. Josh is an assistant professor at Liberty University, among lots of other things. And you can check out what we're talking about today at a website, 226parenting.com. That's 226parenting.com. And you can follow Joshua on Twitter at Joshua Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B. Joshua, welcome back to The Reconnect.
Thank you so much, Carmen. It's an honor.
All right. So before we get into 22-6, let's talk about marriage and parenting sort of in the wide scope conversation. Like, what challenges are you seeing parents and families facing out there today? What kind of challenges are you helping them address?
Yeah, you know, I think at the very front end of this is a lot of these are interconnected. I think at the very front end is busyness. I hear a lot from parents in particular, also just couples who are married who don't even have kids, just how busyness is creeping in and how to slow down a little bit. And we can talk about each of these. I would say number two is screens. And screens is a very, very highly discussed topic. And it also goes into the issue of parents finding pornography on their teenagers, you know, screens and that type of thing. Screens is a big one, and I think it adds completely to the busyness of our culture. And then the other one that I would really highlight is just the really the pace and the pain, the pressures of life, how it all kind of comes together. The fast pace, which I talked about, we're dealing with a lot of stuff in our lives, just with our families, maybe. Broken relationships and that type of thing. So we're carrying a lot of just different pains that we have into our relationships, into our marriages. Maybe it's in-laws. Maybe it has to do with just even the issue of having a baby. I mean, we work a lot with families and walk alongside a lot of families who are just in the early years of parenting and are trying to balance the demands of life and trying to stay connected in their marriage while they have children. And then the last one is really the pressure of deadlines, the pressure of having to make a living. I really think a lot of these things are just add an extra pressure on us in the relationships that matter most to us.
Wow. You have, you're striking all the chords that I know that, you know, as a working parent, I know that the busyness component of it, I know that my staff has heard me say, like, I just feel like I have no margin. And you and I both know that when, as adults, as married people, we lack margin, the people who suffer because of that are definitely, you know, our kids. It's our relationships, it's our closest relationships, where we tend to, you know, that's what we cut into when we're lacking margin in other places. And so that busyness aspect, and I agree with you. I think the screens component for adults is just as problematic as the screens component for kids. And so, you know, am I on my phone in one way or another, even when I'm in the car or even when I'm in those sacred minutes before, you know, kids drop off to sleep at night or first thing in the morning when they get up? You know, those are the opportunities that we really do have to invest in them in ways that, you know, just aren't going to be available to us forever. And am I giving up those even minutes, let alone hours, to some kind of attention to social media or something else? So let's talk through those. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Well, I was going to mention that, you know, to your point there is what, and I wrote a blog post on this not long back. We actually have a podcast episode on it called how secondhand screen time is influencing and impacting our kids, how secondhand screen time is harming our kids. And I haven't heard secondhand screen time used anywhere else, so maybe I can coin it myself. But it's like secondhand smoke. I mean, it's the effects of somebody else using a screen. And the research, this is peer-reviewed research that shows that what's happening is when a parent is on their phone and an infant, a baby, a toddler, or a child is pulling on, figuratively speaking and even literally speaking, pulling on the pant legs of mom or dad and saying, hey, look at me, look at me. And we're, you know, just engrossed in our phones. It's impacting the pleasure system of our kids' brains and actually increasing anxiety and depression. And we're seeing the research is just becoming more and more robust as it relates to the increasing anxiety and depression in our kids today. And a lot of this research is pointing back to screens as being a primary reason that this is happening. And so you're exactly right. It's not just our kids being on it. It's the effects and influence of us being on it in front of our kids when really, especially in those key times of the day, as you mentioned, those are the times that Moses described for us to be able to really influence and write love and commands of God in the tablet of our children's hearts. And so that adds to that pace and pain and pressure when we're sitting on our phones and sitting on our screens, when really we could be capitalizing, really spending great time with our kids.
Man, that's so convicting. Friends, I'm talking with Joshua Straub. You can follow him on Twitter at Joshua Straub, S-T-R-A-U-B. The podcast that he just referenced is called In This Together. Josh and Christy, he and his wife do this weekly podcast together. That's a free resource we would commend to you. And you can check out what we're about to talk about at 226parenting.com as well. Let's get into that. Let's talk about 226 Parenting, how you got started, and what you see God doing through this particular effort.
Yeah, so we were, you know, we have two little kiddos ourselves, and our heart has been to really look at this next generation and say, how can we influence the next generation for Christ? And what does that look like? And we realized as we looked across the landscape that and looked at research and looked through scripture is that the single biggest factor in raising a next generation of kids to love God and love others really begins in the home, and it begins with parents. But yet so many of us weren't discipled ourselves by our own parents. And so, you know, we don't really know what it's like or what it means to disciple our kids. Or maybe we have a lot of fears. You know, I know for us, I mean, Christy has listed a list of fears that she has as a mom. You know, fear of messing them up, feeling like we're not getting enough time with our kids, those types of things, because it goes by quickly. And so we really wanted to create a resource that was scripturally based, that was a great way for us to capitalize on those moments I just mentioned in Deuteronomy 6, that, you know, the morning time when we walk along the way, or what today's version of that is drive time, bedtime, and then also dinner time. And we combine research with scripture to, for instance, a great example of that is we created dinner time stories. And research shows over and over again that when we tell certain types of stories to our kids during dinner time, it actually builds self-confidence and self-competence in them later in life. And so we've created content around those four key times of the day to walk and journey with parents in a community to just walk together to disciple our kids and to capitalize on the moments God has given us each day. And so it has been an unbelievable community of supporting one another. I think the single biggest thing we've learned, and just real quickly, it's based on Proverbs 22:6, to raise a child in the way they should go, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. And so we just, we really break down that verse. And I think the single biggest thing that we have found is that parents often feel alone, like they're the only ones dealing with the issue that they have going on, whether it's a discipline issue or whatever. And this community has been so incredible, because what's happening is a parent will write in, say what they're dealing with, and five or six parents within the hour are jumping in and saying, I'm dealing with that too. So I think that sense of universality has been just really a neat piece of this whole journey.
So I'll just note to you, I've just been disturbed by things that I've been reading and hearing, even just in the last couple of days and weeks. I read something in The Atlantic about smartphones and
yeah.
Right, and it's something along the lines like has a smartphone destroyed a generation, and yep. You know, it's this concept that we think all of that access to technology is actually making our kids happy. That's what they tell us they want to be doing, but that actually, you know, it's driving them not only away from relationships with us, it's driving them away from healthy activities that include anything other than screen time. And then I'm also, you know, I'm just disturbed by sort of recent statistics that 55% of kids in America are now born outside of wedlock. And so I'm sort of surveying the landscape and I'm saying, all right, as Christian parents, we're going to do absolutely the very best that we can. We recognize that children are a sacred trust from the Lord. We recognize that we have this very short, brief window of time in which to, you know, do what Proverbs 22:6 commends to us to do. We have all these fears, you know, related to messing them up or not getting it right or not doing it as well as the person who, you know, has the time and privilege of homeschooling or whatever. Like, we heap it on ourselves. And so I want you to, you know, speak to the Christian mom, the Christian dad who's listening right now, who just feels like, I can't get this right. And let them, you know, let them hear from your heart, because you are so on the forefront of speaking a word of forgiveness into the lives of adults and parents. And so speak that word to us now.
Yeah, I would say this, that so much of us get caught up in the day-to-day. You know, our kids are acting out, you know, they're throwing temper tantrums, whatever that looks like, and we just feel like we're messing it up. And I would say this, that research shows that, and I talk a lot about emotional safety, and I wrote this, as you mentioned earlier, in Safe House. I talk a lot about emotional safety and the whole idea that part of that emotional safety piece is there's research that shows if we get that right just 2 out of 5 times, that's 40% of the time, that we're still going to get the outcomes we're looking for in our kids. And because we're going to mess up, we're going to say things we regret to our kids, we're going to yell at our kids when we shouldn't, we're going to do things because we're human. But the research tells us that the ultimate of relationships is a word called repair. And the Bible calls it, I believe, it's directly connected to forgiveness, and Jesus tells us to practice it a lot. And I think the power of this is that when we mess up, what we're doing, when we say I'm sorry to our kids and we're specific about our offense, I'm sorry that I yelled at you, I shouldn't have done that, I'm sure that it made you feel, you know, horribly, whatever that looks like, but we're being very specific, we're getting on their level, we're apologizing to them. What it really does is it shows our kids that we're not perfect, and it also shows them indirectly that we don't expect them to be perfect, and we also are showing them how to write it when they're not, how to make it right when they're not. And I would just really encourage parents to say, listen, research shows over and over and over again that it's not necessarily what we know about parenting that makes this that matters for outcomes in kids. It's who we're becoming as adults. In other words, our kids don't do as we say, they do as we do. Our kids become who we are as adults. And so if you're feeling overwhelmed, find ways to take time for yourself. Implement the Sabbath in your home. If you're a two-parent home, switch off and on. My wife and I switch off and on when we can go to the gym. I take the kids in the evening so she can go to the gym. She'll take them, or I'll try to get there before I get home from work. We try to allow each other the opportunities to grow and thrive, because we cannot give from an empty tank, and that's most likely when we're yelling and snapping and biting back. So I would just really encourage, Proverbs 22:6 says to train a child in the way they should go. At the very front of that is the train. It really comes back to the person training, the teacher, the parent themselves, and who they're becoming. So just really encourage you, when you mess up, seek forgiveness. And number two, really find the time to pour into yourself and seek the Lord, because we can't get from an empty tank.
All right, friends, the website is 226parenting.com. And if you go there, you're going to find all kinds of content related to morning prayers and bedtime stories and dinner time stories and drive time games and weekly Bible stories and recommended resources. And we'll add to that today the In This Together podcast that that Joshua and his wife Christy do together on a weekly basis. The book, if you have not discovered it yet, is called Safe House: How Emotional Safety is the Key to Raising Kids Who Live, Love, and Lead Well. Joshua, thank you so much for being with us again today here on The Reconnect. But maybe more importantly, thank you for what you're doing for us, because, man, you know, it's hard, and you know it. I know you know it personally, but, you know, thank you for helping to not only encourage, but to equip us to be the kinds of parents that God calls us to be.
It's a complete honor, and I thank you for what you're doing.
All right, friends, so it's time to go below the fold. This is the point in the show where we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start or engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles can change not only the course of the conversation, but another person's thinking and maybe even their living. So how long do you really want to live? Right? That's going to be the question I'm going to lift up today. It's kind of a question about longevity. It's kind of a question about reality. It's kind of a question about what's going on around us. And it's a conversation that it was sparked in my own thinking and my own conversations by two events. The first was the recent death of the oldest living man. We talked about him the other day, 113 years old in Israel, an Auschwitz survivor. And his life and the length of it got me thinking. But so did this particular, I will describe it as a humor piece by Tom Purcell in a website called Online Athens. I follow all kinds of news sites online, and sometimes I follow sites from like particular towns just to sort of see what's going on locally in, what's the warp and woof of the local news cycle. So wherever you live, there's a rhythm to the news in your locale that's not necessarily the national rhythm of the news. So anyway, this is one of those more local stories. So what the writer's noting here is that there are scientists who are now arguing that humans might not only live to as old as this latest individual who lived to 113, but that humans might actually start living like 115 years, and others think it's even possible that human beings might live as long as 125 years. Well, if you're a student of the Bible, you know that there was a time in history when people lived a whole lot longer than that. And the further and further away we have gotten from Eden and the perfection of it, maybe the harder life and reality and the toxins and pollution and all of that. Just all of it was wearing on us and probably over time shortening our lifespan. But the question is now, as we live in a culture, in a time with medical technology and access to relatively good health care for an awful lot of people, what would it look like to live 125 years? Do you want to live 125 years? Do you even have any desire to live that long? And it made me start thinking, is it actually possible, and the humorist asked this question in the article, is it actually possible maybe to have too much of a good thing? Now, that comes from the perspective that this is as good as it gets, and so you want to live here as long as is physically possible, because after all, this is all there is, and this is as good as it gets. Now, you as a Christian, you and I as Christians, we know that's just not true. Not only is this not as good as it gets, this is not all that there is. In fact, there is going to be a time and a place where life is going to be infinitely better, infinitely good, only good, with the absolute absence of evil in all ways. And so we look forward to that, but it's not something like a pie in the sky reality. We do absolutely savor the Savior right here and right now. We absolutely, in the context of the days of this life, we want to taste and see that the Lord is good here in the land of the living. I mean, there's no question about that. We want to demonstrate to others the goodness of God's creation and the goodness of redemption in Jesus Christ here and now. But we also, if we're honest with ourselves, we honestly look forward to heaven. We honestly look forward to it. If you're not looking forward to heaven, if you're not anticipating what wonder and joy it's going to be to not only be known fully, which is already true, but to fully know God, if you're not looking forward to that, if you don't have this great welling up of anticipation about getting to spend eternity with the Father in His full presence, with the full knowledge of who He is, then my guess is that you do not yet have the right perception of who God is. Like, it's going to be great. It's not just going to be good. It's going to be great. This entire conversation about how long we live, how long we want to live, and the relative goodness of life also got me thinking about the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you haven't read the book of Ecclesiastes recently, I kind of to commend it to you. Now, it's not really a comfort. It's not a book that lays out for you, sort of like righteous living principles. In fact, it's pretty much a book about unrighteous living principles, but that's the point. If you take everything in the world to its absolute extreme, if you take everything that's good about the world and you take it to its absolute extreme, you end up with what the writer of Ecclesiastes is describing, right? Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. Is that what constitutes the good life? For a lot of our neighbors, the perception of reality is that's what constitutes the good life. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. And so we need to help our neighbors understand that the good life is actually the redemption of the goodness of God's good creation, of a relationship with God, of a restored relationship with Him, where sin and its power over us in this life is literally put down in Jesus Christ. The other conversation I think we have to have with our neighbors is the goal of longevity, or is the goal of eternity? I want you to consider that for yourself as well. Am I actually interested in living forever, or am I interested in living for as long as I possibly can here on earth, no matter what that life looks like? What does the good life constitute for you, and who gets to define what is good? So those are challenging questions that I would invite us to be considering and be thinking about. And then in terms of heaven, you ultimately have to ask the question this way. You know, heaven is going to be amazing. It's going to be magnificent. It's going to be marvelous. It's indescribable. Are you really dying to get there? You're going to have to die to get there. There's no question about that. But in terms of your heart of hearts and how you feel, your affection toward God, your affection toward wanting to be with Him, heaven is for real. Are you dying to get there? I'm dying to get there, man. So I'm just put that out there for you. I actually am a person who is probably more excited about eternity than longevity. Although I recognize that, if God gave me the privilege of living 115, 125 years, man, I am going to seek to live each and every one of those days to His glory, pressing the full force of my life into everything that God intends in terms of the advancement of the gospel in this generation. All right, friends, I want you to visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. In addition to this daily program, we have a ministry called Reconnect One, and it is a short version of what we do here on the Reconnect every day. And it's a great, easy, wonderful way of sharing this idea about reconnecting the eternal with the everyday with your neighbors and friends. So it's really easy to invite somebody to listen to something that's 1 minute long. And so I'm going to invite you to do that. I'd also invite you to join us in sharing this podcast with others. All right, friends, this is the Reconnect. That's all I got time for today. Connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.